Who are you and why are you here?
Because I know that on the outside I can look at something
like Craig Calvi, and we're showing some cool bikes.
Excellent. Obviously, you're one of the longer time carbon builders around in terms of small frame builders, but you're a whole lot more than that. You've built a ton of bikes over time, going way back. Maybe you can talk about how you started with bicycles, sort of like what you started with before you got known as Craig Calvi doing carbon bikes.
Well, I started working with carbon fiber in the mid-80s, building rowing shells and kayaks with Ted Van Dusen of Composite Engineering. These are gold medal winning boats. So they were at a very high level of...
Was this at a college or something?
Yeah, after college. I went to Pratt and majored in sculpture. I dropped out and traveled the world and then came back and got a job building boats. So from that beginning, I started working with carbon, and I had a bike accident on a Schwinn Varsity. That was my commute bike, and I bent the frame, which is actually kind of hard to do on a Schwinn Varsity, so it was a dramatic accident. But I had been thinking about building a frame from the materials I was playing with at work. So I did, and that first bike was awesome. It had this great vibration damping quality to it.
About what time, what year was that approximately?
That was in 1987. So that bike inspired me to build another one and then kind of keep going with it. Eventually, I quit that job and decided to go to California and start a company building carbon bikes.
Who was doing stuff similar at the time? Was it like Kestrel or something like that?
Kestrel was making frames, where they were just starting, actually. They had just come out with their first bike in 87 as well. Look was the other company, and Trek was dabbling in carbon tubes and aluminum lugs. So, you know, there's the carbon tube, aluminum lugs. Kestrel was doing the bladder molded thing. And I was had my own system, you know, that we still use today.
And you're doing, like, laid-up joints?
Yeah, building carbon lugs, basically. Either on the tubes directly or separately and then gluing tubes. So we had a couple things going. And then later we developed a wrapping technique on the tandems where it's a hand-wrapped joint. So that's another common technique that's being used nowadays.
So soon after you were building, I'm trying to remember my dates. I'm not a super historian guy, but you built some of the Le Mans stuff, right?
Yeah, we built Greg's bikes in 90-91.
But what led up to that kind of thing? Like, where, I mean, just you're not just going to start building bikes for Greg Le Mans. What got you there?
Well, he had a great need for a custom geometry carbon fiber frame. He had been riding the TVT slash Look bike, Look frames, and they tried to do custom geometry by gluing the carbon tubes into the aluminum lugs at weird angles, and they actually broke. The team got some of those bikes, and they were breaking them. So Greg and his team, basically, they kind of revolted and said, we're just going to ride the steel bikes. You know, we don't like this stupid carbon stuff that just keeps breaking.
They were thinking about their careers and things like that.
Well, yeah, and Greg was wanting the whole team to have the advantage of carbon. So he was wanting the whole team on carbon. And this is, mind you, this is 1991.
Sure.
So he's way ahead of his time. And
he was known for that.
Yeah, and we were doing custom carbon. We didn't know that he needed that, but we found out through the Time Sport guy, J.P. Pascal, that they were actively looking for someone to make carbon frames that could be done in a custom geometry. And we were basically the only game in town at that point.
And did you end up masking them as times, or how did that work? Was he riding time frames?
No, he had started his own company by then.
That was under Le Mans brand.
Le Mans Cycles. So we put Le Mans decals on them, and he effectively licensed our patents and hired me and my crew to move to Reno and build, you know, under management of Le Mans Cycles. So we did that, and I started developing other products on the side. But that deal kind of ended. It crashed and burned when Le Mans' company basically went bankrupt. And so we survived that, though. We did okay and got back into
business. You were essentially a kind of a separate entity intellectually.
Right, right. They were licensing my patents, basically. So that was about it.
Okay, so, you know, I think back to, like, maybe not that far back, but say late 90s, I'm looking at bikes of yours on the wall. You've got these beautiful like carbon lugs with the webbing and all that sort of cool stuff. And, you know, at the time, they were so advanced in my mind. They had titanium and aluminum all over the bike, just using a really nice use of resources. And this belongs here, we're going to use titanium. This over here, we're going to use aluminum. And then on top of that, the beautiful carbon work. At a time when carbon was still fairly rare, I mean, maybe at the very upper echelon, but you weren't getting like the sweet stuff you were doing. What was sort of happening with you building bikes at that time, and were you focused on bikes?
Yeah, the bikes were the bread and butter, and we do some special projects, but yeah, we were focused on developing the technology, making a yet even lighter bike. You know, that was always the push to try to go even lighter. But we still do have this philosophy that, yes, a light bike is nice, but you have to be able to survive a minor crash and get back up on the bike and continue racing or riding. Just, I mean, we come from a racing background with Le Mans and all that, but so the criteria is what makes a better bike. And the newer bikes are just too fragile. So we maintained that minimum wall thickness and a certain amount of impact toughness.
And the durability is valued.
Yeah, the durability was an issue for us, but then these really light carbon bikes started coming out. It was actually the Scandium aluminum bikes that came out first, lighter than the carbon, lighter than ours, but they were failing pretty readily. They were breaking, fatigue cracking, basically. So the Scandium didn't last too long, but the carbon bikes kept getting lighter and lighter, but they were quite fragile. So we tried fighting that, you know, by repairing our own frames. And if you crashed it, we can repair it. And people kept calling us saying, well, can you repair my Scott, you know, Addict or my Colnago? And it's like, no, get a Calfee and, you can have that service. Like, but that we just kept getting all these calls. So we said, well, if you can't beat them, repair them. So we started a repair business around that. But yeah, the basic philosophy was toughness and durability is still important in bikes.
Where did you grow after that? I'm thinking back to pre-natural fibers. What was the growth of that, or was that pretty much it? Repairing, getting it lighter, making refining, that kind of stuff. Was there anything else going on at the time? Were you sponsoring any teams, or were there bikes hidden under riders at the time or things like that?
We were in the triathlon market for a while there, sponsored Dave Scott and the DuBoom brothers. And so we were kind of doing some stuff with aerodynamics, mainly in positioning, body positioning, and studying aerodynamics back before aero tubing came out, and found that the aero tubing wasn't that important. There was a lot of other things that were, and a lot of new modern bikes do address that. But we decided not to continue with the aero project and got more into the custom aspects and doing the shaped lugs on the Dragonfly that came out in like the early 2000s. So we got into the shaped carbon lug thing, which is now everywhere. And doing work with other companies building better carbon forks. We worked closely with Alpha Q to refine their carbon steerer fork. This is after the Kestrel fork came out. We wanted an all-carbon fork, knowing that the steer tube was the next thing that needed carbon. So.
And that you could integrate it right into the crown and the rest of the structure.
Yeah, the whole one-piece molded carbon fork. So we helped push that along. And then the bar stem, that was a new one. The first carbon handlebars were coming out. And we immediately recognized that clamping a carbon handlebar and torquing it in a sprint is just a bad thing, you know, for carbon.
And you solved that problem with an improvement overall.
Yeah, there's been several ways to improve that. One is attention on that clamping area and orienting the fibers properly in the handlebar, which wasn't the case in the early ones. Now they've all figured it out. But then we went straight to our bar stem, our one-piece bar and stem combo. And that's something we've been doing for a really long time now, and it's still
really nice.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's light. It's absolutely secure.
So let's go back to the natural fibers. What where did that come from, and sort of what were you intending with that? Because sort of like I'm thinking back, I'm trying to remember like it was the first San Jose show, it was probably the first time I saw it. Not that you weren't doing it before that, but I was just like, oh, there you go. This guy's killing it. He's coming full circle on this stuff because the stuff was so good that now he's just going to show everyone how good you can be caveman style.
Well, I built the first modern bamboo bike in 1995. And it had been sort of this special project, just various special friends and employees would build them. And we finally decided to start selling them. And we brought it out at a New York show. I don't even remember the year. But I also brought that bike to the Houston show, the first NABS show. And we got a People's Choice Award for it. You know, 20 builders in a hotel ballroom and... Yeah, it was fun to bring home a big trophy. It's cool. But we got a lot of recognition for that because it was so new and different. And when people actually rode the bike, they just came back just amazed at the ride quality. It was very similar to when I built my first carbon bike. The ride quality, the vibration damping and smoothness of it was just absolutely noticeable. Well, the bamboo was just more of a good thing. Now, it wasn't a lighter bike. I knew I couldn't make it as light as carbon, but I thought, well, why not? You know, it's bamboo. It grows out of the ground. There's all these green reasons to do it.
But were you looking at doing a high-performance bike with it at that time? Was that the goal, high-performance bike?
The aspect of high performance that bamboo brings is the vibration damping, which makes you less tired in a long ride. You know, the vibration that affects you on a long ride makes you more tired. Not so much the pedaling effort, but the vibrations.
Sure, sure.
So we realized that and did some studies. And actually, there's been a couple of Ironman triathletes that measured their performance on these long-distance training rides. And they have a really nice, light Calfee Dragonfly, you know, triathlon bike. And then they get a bamboo bike for training purposes, just like, you know, I don't gonna use my race bike.
Right.
And they measure themselves being faster on the bamboo bike.
That's interesting.
And they're wondering why. So we did some research and found that the vibration damping affects athletic performance. And that's what's led to our Manta suspension. So the bamboo's there, but we'll never sell bamboo as a performance material when carbon's right there. But the suspension and the isolation of vibration is something we could look at and apply to a carbon bike. And so that's sort of become our Manta bike. And
yeah, it's a gorgeous
bike. That's our newest, you know, effort.
You know, I'm looking at the bike behind you in the frame and everything like that. And, you know, you're talking about getting your start as a sculptor. And is that what's coming out in these types of carbon bikes? I mean, these types of bamboo bikes. Are you looking at it like it's a kinetic sculpture, but it's got utility and it's got fun? It's got a lot of elements, but do you just get to be a little bit more creative as a sculptor?
Yeah, especially this part.
Yeah, it's cool.
I, you know, usually we kind of make this all smooth, but I thought, you know, when we were wrapping it, it just had this muscular look. And I thought, well, let's kind of make it more muscular or just give it some...
So it's a creature.
Yeah, more organic look to it that just looks, I don't know, it has this neat... And yeah, I use my sculpture background to make these shapes, and actually forming them with files and stuff is takes a lot of skill.
And you've stuck with this type of construction for quite a while.
Yeah.
You know, from like let's say it's not a quote unquote performance bike, and it's another kind of bike. And you've done various show bikes over the years.
Yeah.
And themes and tandems and this, that, and the other thing. Do you get to like kind of relax a little when you work with this?
Oh yeah. These are my fun bikes.
They're
fun. Yeah, okay. I mean the other ones are fun too, but kind of been there, done that, you know, as a designer.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
So I've kind of worked that over and refining it and setting up ways to satisfy customers with, you know, custom needs and, you know, picking great paint jobs and work with colors. But back to these kind of things, this level of development is where I really have fun. Because I'm really on the cutting edge of designing an e-bike now.
Sure.
And trying to make it interesting looking, not dorky, you know, and using natural materials is a whole nother thing, which...
The shape of this bike makes you think of like a CT70 or something.
Yeah, you know, it's and from a marketing perspective, the person who wants to replace their car with an e-bike, you know, a 40-mile-an-hour e-bike, not a 29-mile-an-hour e-bike, you know, it's because they're going to go on a fast road and want to ride with traffic, is going to need turn signals and a taillight and a big headlight.
It's got to be proper.
Yeah. And they're saving the world with their e-bike. Well, why not make it out of bamboo?
Sure.
Because that's a whole nother, like, green expression.
Yes.
So that getting that design refined and packaged properly and working, and just making the battery to fit inside the tube, that was a real challenge. Nobody makes a battery like that, so we had to make our own battery. And
you mean, you know, like, make the actual... battery itself, or are you doing a pack out of cells?
We're doing a pack out of 18650
sure.
cells,
okay.
So it's, which are great,
yeah.
But making those packs is actually...
They're good enough for Toyota, right?
They're quite challenging, yeah. And yeah, good for Tesla and Toyota. They're, so the units that you work with and how you wire them together and make it safe with a BMS and all that is actually a whole new realm for me.
So this is really where you're thrilled right now, where your direction is heading, is the e-bike... and the utility of the urban customer that's looking to shift modes.
Yeah, getting more people on bikes. You know, that's a big theme for me. And there's also a project in Africa that's using elements of e-bikes to generate electricity on a stationary bike. It's a mobile electricity generating station.
Power plant.
Yeah, mobile power plant, because they have cell phones, and the cell phone battery is going dead all the time.
Sure.
So it's like currency. It's almost like money is electricity.
It's current currency.
It is. It literally is. And it comes down to who has charge in their battery, you know, gets to play the music and gets to send money from one place to another, because they send money over their cell phones now.
Sure, and they take their cut.
So it's a huge deal. And having a the business is...
There was a group of engineers doing water pumps for Changing Africa, too.
Yeah.
Because it's a huge issue for women over there that... You're going to change the world by getting them water pumps more than anything else.
That's a big one, yeah. Yeah, that would be Kickstart.
Is that the name of
one?
Okay, I talked with them one year at Maker Faire, and I was like, you folks are totally onto something in the right way.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I work with those guys sometimes and have this concept as a technical solution, just a design solution to a massive problem.
Sure.
So the bikes that we did, it's not here. Actually, I'll give you a card of the check. This is worth looking at. It's a project in the Congo, which is a place that needs a lot of help. You can pick your favorite one or take all of them.
I'll take this one.
Yeah, there's a shot of the bike. So there's one that doesn't have the electric generator on it. But
so this is Africans building bikes in Africa.
Yeah.
For their use.
For transporting farm produce to market. Or in this case, with an accessory generating electricity.
So it frees up, in essence, a construction method so they can add utility as they need it, as you've decided they need it.
Oh, yeah. That's totally free system. So
they can
develop things.
Because that's always the problem with the third world, is stop coming here and telling us what we need.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, we know what we need, or let us adapt it. But, you know, they get into trouble with that.
Oh, it's a huge problem. Yeah. Yeah. So I've learned a lot since I went over there first. First time I was in Africa was in 84, when I traveled across from Kenya to Cameroon through the Congo. That was a long time ago, and I was just hitchhiking. But this most...
Watch, hitchhiking across Africa.
Yeah.
That's quite a thing.
Yeah, it was exciting. But, you know, at the age of 22, you can do anything, you know.
Well, I mean, there's limits.
Yeah, and there were some limits.
I'm not going to go hitchhiking across Brazil anytime soon.
Yeah. But I went back in 07, but I went to a new place in Ghana, and we started building bamboo bikes in Ghana, in Zambia, Uganda.
Now, what's their take on that when they see this? It's like, would they just rather, hey, just give us some steel, give us some regular cheap bikes and we'll use those? Or what's the difference when they're building with the carbon? I mean, I pointed out that they can modify, but like, what's the real difference? Because, you know, they don't have much, and it's like, you could just give us some bikes here and we'd totally use them. Because well, even if you give them a carbon bike, they still need everything else.
Yeah, there's already donated used bikes flowing into Africa, so that's uh-huh. already exists. This is more about making a bike specific to their needs, because a lot of the bikes they get aren't suitable for what they need them for.
Because they're going to use them for agriculture, for
these
delivery.
Are for all kinds of stuff, but carrying stuff ends up being a big one. So what they really need is a cargo bike. But nobody's donating used cargo bikes. They're all like crappy Walmart bikes that get used yeah. and then they break in very short period
all
of time.
All the cargo bikes in the U.S. are being used to go fetch coffee, too.
Yeah, so it's sort of a... Anyway, so we built basically a cargo bike design and showed them how to design whatever bike. You know, you want to carry especially water or lumber or, you know, build trailers. So they can do whatever they want with a... Give them the tools... to go build what they want rather than just give them the thing and it doesn't last.
What parts of that, from the African point of view, can they get all that sourced locally? Is that the thing? Are they able to make like latex resins or God knows what? I don't know how that all works, but
yeah,
like, is it mostly like it's you're not just giving them the skill set, you're giving them, hey,
also,
this stuff's in your backyard.
Well, we're giving them a supply chain for the things that need to be imported. But yeah, the bamboo is the single largest material that they need to use. The fiber they get locally.
Is there a lot of bamboo in Africa?
Yeah, there's plenty of bamboo in
Africa.
Okay,
so they're all set there.
Yeah,
the
epoxy is an issue. So yeah, we have to import epoxy and the bike parts. So we get like these wheels are sort of a model for a prototype, effectively, for an African wheel where you don't have to bring in spokes and... of a certain length and nipples and rims.
Fussy parts.
Yeah, all these things. So.
And this thing can be repaired eminently.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, they're super strong and.
The solid rubber tires and everything.
No, they're still pneumatic tires, but trying to find solutions, you know, that don't need to be imported.
Okay.
And the current program in the Congo is especially problematic because it's so impossible to import stuff there now with all the civil unrest.
So you're just. Up against a wall in terms of just moving epoxy.
Well,
it doesn't flow.
It doesn't flow that well. I mean, we make it flow, but it's expensive and it becomes, you know, ridiculous. But you know, there's a lot of people who want to see this happen, and eventually things will settle out and it won't be crazy expensive to ship epoxy over there. But I mean, there's challenges that we're working through.
Okay, I'm going to switch modes here. You know, I'm in the Bay Area, I'm in the North Bay, you're in the South Bay, but, you know, going to things like Maker Faire or around, you know, I see your hand in a lot of things. I mean, what was that helicopter that was Maker Faire one time?
Yeah, we'd be there next this coming Maker Faire.
It's hard for me to go too often because it's kind of, you know, do I really need to look at another 3D printer?
Right.
But, like, there's lots of cool stuff, but you've been doing that. What other pots do you have your hands into in terms of, like, creations? You're obviously just a massively creative guy, and the stuff you do is very high end and stuff like that. Where, what else are you doing that maybe we don't know about that would be cool to know about?
Probably the electric motorcycle stuff. Yeah. So
okay. Who are you doing that with?
On our own. I have a California motorcycle manufacturer's license.
Excellent.
So I can put, you know, I make my own VIN numbers and I have my own license plates.
What type of motorcycles are you doing?
Electric motorbikes that
what
are...
I mean, like, yeah, I'm a motorcycle guy, so you
well,
gotta break it down.
Yeah, basically just commuter bikes, street commuters, street bikes.
Uh-huh.
No, not too many dirt bikes at this point.
What materials?
Well, the bikes themselves, we haven't made any like actual design from the ground up bikes. We're modifying bikes and using effectively what I... Long story short is I got a bunch of Zero motors. The Zero motorcycles, earlier motors that had problems with retaining the magnets on the rotor. So there's a quality control problem on new motors. I solved the problem for it. They hired me to solve that problem if they needed it solved. Turns out they ended up getting new motors from the supplier, and they effectively scrapped the old motors to me.
Wow, that's cool.
So I have a whole bunch of motors that I'm wrapping with carbon and making them actually higher performance. So now what do I do with these motors? I might as well make vehicles out of,
sure,
you know.
Okay,
as a
cool.
So I have a nice head start on making an electric motorbike.
And obviously you're working on batteries and building battery
yeah,
packs and
yeah.
things like that. How
yeah.
about controllers? Are you just using some off-the-shelf controllers? I mean, you're obviously connected with those people.
they are using their controllers?
Yeah, using Sevcon controllers, but looking at other controllers too, because it's tricky to learn the Sevcon stuff.
I haven't touched any of that stuff, so it's hard for me to know what works best where or how that all works.
You need a lot of patience to work with it.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, is in short supply sometimes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we're involved in a lot of cool electric projects, flying vehicles and rolling vehicles.
Is the flying vehicle electric?
The next one will be. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. We've got three.
How much airtime do you get?
We have three flying vehicle projects going.
And is this all done in your do you have a compound or how's your shop?
Well, we have
that?
A kind of a big shop, and we have a back area that's sort of I've carved out for the electric vehicle stuff. So we have two airplanes there and one down in L.A. that's getting worked on.
Who do you like or who do you tend to work with a lot in terms of creative projects?
My friend Dezier Molnar, I've been working with him on the flying motorcycle, the gyrocopter that converts to a motorbike. And we're both working on this electric version of a fixed-wing aircraft that converts to a roadworthy vehicle. And that's all electric.
Cool. It's really nice to see all your creativity whenever I'm around. It's always something that you've got up your sleeve. I can't imagine the man hours. I mean, are you running this like an Edison type of thing where you have a lot of people underneath you that are smart and you're giving little tasks? Or are you the brain trust and you have people working hard at your direction? Or are you just thinking stuff up and working hard, just straight up manpower?
Kind of all of the above. I mean, there's certain projects that I just tackle and do, like this e-bike is pretty much me and a guy helped finish it. I did have a guy help me on the battery a little bit. And then there's projects like with Dezier, where he directs it and I just help with the carbon stuff. The airplane project with the contra-rotating propellers and the contra-rotating electric motor, I'm kind of trying that. But
the motor's rotating too.
Well, it's two motors. One rotates clockwise, the other one goes clockwise.
Oh, okay.
And the shaft.
Counter-rotating of the rotation itself.
Yeah, but on the same axis.
Okay, yeah.
So that, I'm trying to find a partner to work with on that.
But that's a lot of work that you're talking about. I mean, I make stuff that's a lot simpler and it takes a lot of time. Who's building your production, like regular sport bicycles and stuff like that while you're doing all this?
Well, I do the custom drawings and custom layouts and work on the tooling, but I have a whole staff of employees that actually does the labor on it.
How many people are in your operation?
Well, it varies depending on on special projects, but anywhere from 18 to 30, you know, is kind of the range.
And do you pull people off of the bicycles and into the copters or the motorcycles? Is it flexible like that? Is it very
flexible.
Departmental?
It's both. We have the repair department, which is very busy, and those guys, you know, they are pretty much booked all the time. And then the single bike crew, they occasionally jump in on special projects.
Okay.
And the paint shop has got some really skilled guys. I pulled a paint prep guy to do some of the sanding on the e-bike, and he knocked it out way faster than I could.
Okay.
So he did a really nice job of the finish here.
Yeah, it looks gorgeous. You know, I love like I said, the shape's really cool about this. You know, there's some things that I'm not into, but there's definitely like this old CT70 looking theme that I'm like, it just kind of makes me feel that way.
Yeah.
Like if, let's say you were going to give some advice to people that are looking at working with fibers and epoxies. You know, you've got a huge amount of experience. What's sort of like your way of looking at that, working with that material and doing well with it that other people might be able to like glean a lot from if you said so?
Well, it's all about the fiber orientation.
Yeah.
You know, how you point the fiber. A lot of people treat composites like a replacement for metal, and they just think of it in a monolithic way, like these balanced weave panels. Or just things that are not, they don't take advantage of the orientation of the fiber.
Like which ways the stresses are going and all that.
Yeah, and how you're, like, let's say a simple hole, like in our water bottle cage, just for example, let's look
sure.
at that real quick.
Okay, cool.
The water bottle cage, simple thing, but we don't drill this hole that holds the bottle cage to the bike. We form the hole because we want the fibers to go around the hole, and not make a stress riser there, so when somebody yanks on the cage too hard, it doesn't break.
Right.
So little stuff like that can be applied.
And it's not too many people that do special things with water bottles out there.
Yeah, they're all...
There are a few, but not a lot.
Yeah, they're basically all made in China, and they're kind of crappy. They're all done the same way. Like, somebody copied someone, and that's how they're all done.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's... We see a lot of that around here.
Yeah, so this is a totally different way to make a bottle cage. And my point, though, is the fiber orientation and not necessarily cutting through fibers unless it's a good thing to cut the fiber is kind of the secret sauce of designing something efficiently.
So just not trying not to terminate that strand is really good.
When is it good
to cut a fiber?
Well, on the edge of something, you know, like a finished edge of a molding, you know, you're cutting it. You could try to get the fibers all wrapping around, like on here. There's not too many cut fibers.
Sure.
But on a molded part, there is.
For this wrapped part here, you're just using some batten or a twine.
Roving.
Roving is the name for it.
Yeah. It's like yarn.
It's like yarn, and it's what, a couple thousand strands?
It's 50,000.
50,000 in a yarn, and you just
wrap it
around.
And you wind it in a pattern to get, and that pattern determines how it mostly resists the stress of that joint.
And is this finish that we're seeing over the surface simply what's left behind from that process, or did you sort of cap it with a way that looks good?
No, okay. This one is pretty much is the result of that wrapping pattern.
And you wrapped to make this as a lug, or did you just do a fine edge here? Like, was this cut and glued this tube in?
No, we have little forms that form these these curved sections.
So it's almost like a barricade or something like that.
There you go.
Okay, cool. Well, all the bikes look great. I'm looking at trying my hand at carbon soon, I hope.
Okay.
I did a repair recently, and now I'm kind of like, you know, I want to do some full suspension bikes, and it's pain in the butt to do those in steel.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of reaching out there. And I like a lot of your method, because I'm not looking to change the world with super, uber, whatever. I just want to have a bike that works the way I want it to work.
Yeah.
And that'll be cool. I really appreciate the time that you've given me. I thank you, and I hope to see more stuff in the future.
Cool, man. Thanks so much.
Cool.